Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, January 29th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, the National Weather Service of Eureka posts high tide outlook for this weekend. Eureka residents ask what city police will do if feds come. Humboldt ice out protests and general strike planned for Friday and Saturday in solidarity with Minneapolis. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkyone, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
The National Weather Service of Eureka issues a high tide outlook for this weekend, warning of possible flooding in low-hanging areas of the Humboldt Bay. Gabriel Zucker reports.
Today, the National Weather Service of Eureka issued a high tide outlook for this weekend and into Monday, warning of possible flooding around the Humboldt Bay. KMUD talked with James White, a meteorologist that works at the National Weather Service in Eureka. He shared there will be some king tide this weekend, causing possible minor flooding in low areas around the coast. He said this will be nothing like the flooding at the beginning of January.
As we head over the next several days, really starting high tide tomorrow, which will be Friday, and then especially through the weekend, we'll have just a little bit of a king tide, and it'll bring our high tide around the Humboldt Bay here just below 9 feet or so. And usually when we have that kind of king tide, we get pretty minor flooding places like King Salmon or the Arcata Bottoms, and that flooding is mostly a nuisance. You know, a lot of people are thinking about the tide that happened earlier this month at the start of January, and that tide was very unusual and extremely high, much higher than this will be. You know, that tide was in excess of even 10 feet at the North Spit tide gauge. So we're not looking at anything close to that height, but it will just be kind of our average run-of-the-mill king tide causing some of the kind of nuisance flooding in some roads and stuff in those locations. And that'll continue into early next week.
White said that this is normal flooding this time of year, and the high tides will not be affected by the storms that were causing the flooding at the beginning of the month.
So the tide itself is mostly just that time of year. This is the time of year when, you know, the moon and the sun and all the forces that go into that align to give us unusually strong tides. So it's the main driving cause of the king tide. For that very large event early in the month, we had strong storms and stuff, and storm surge overlaid it. For this one, not particularly. There's essentially no storm surge at all, really, because there's really not any storm or strong winds. There is some pretty decent swells that'll continue through the weekend and create some minor hazardous conditions on beaches with higher surf, but that won't really contribute to the tide at all. Most of those places that flood, like King Salmon and stuff, aren't even subjected to surf directly anyway. It's just that time of year for the most part.
This is Gabriel Zucker with KMUD News.
With concerns about federal immigration enforcement at a peak, Eureka residents are asking what city police can do if it happens locally. Daniel Mintz reports.
The intensity of federal immigration enforcement has Eureka residents on edge, and they want to know how the city's police department will respond if the feds show up. The actions of federal policing agencies and how to deal with them was the focus of a public comment period during the January 27th meeting of Eureka's Board of Community Oversight of Police Practices. More than a dozen speakers told the board they're frightened and disgusted by the way federal agencies like Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, and Customs and Border Patrol are conducting themselves. Of high concern are detentions and aggressive response to protests and observation attempts. A member of the local chapter of the nationwide Indivisible organization said, quote, "We need to have some communication in order to ensure that kind of thing doesn't happen." Another member of the group said ICE is carrying out domestic terrorism and expressed the fear and paranoia people are feeling.
I'm here to respectfully ask that we start a very proactive, positive conversation with the EPD so that we can get an understanding as the Eureka community and Humboldt County as a larger community, what we can expect from the EPD and how will they protect us as a community. I've heard just recently through a tweet that we should all be carrying our papers. What does that mean? This is the United States of America. And so I wouldn't even know, you know, if I go traveling to another country, you keep your passport as a prized possession and you hide it. These are things you don't want someone to just get a hold of. I can't tell my kids, oh, walk around with your passport. Well, you know, that's just insanity. My kids have Hispanic last names. Are they going to get pulled over just because they have a Hispanic last name and then get taken away and sent off to some detention center to be terrorized and treated just, you know, horrifically? If anyone's watching the news, they're seeing this stuff happen day in, day out, all day long, and it is terrifying.
Although the Eureka Police Department's history includes use of force and conduct controversies, it's now well regarded, and several speakers said they have a lot of respect for it. But they questioned whether local police will provide protection if federal officers attack them, saying, quote, people are being executed on our streets for all to see. A speaker implored the city to, quote, work out police policies now to help protect us all from the crimes of ICE when they arrive. Brian Terry, who described himself as a 37-year-old Roman Catholic nurse, said protesters also need Eureka police to tell them what they should do to avoid danger.
When I first moved to Humboldt, one thing I was told repeatedly, the one thing everyone in Humboldt County has in common is that we all love to protest. And I think seeing people out in front of that courthouse every day for the last 15 years like I have really brought that point home to me. There are going to be protests on both sides. And we really need to know what we can do to keep ourselves, keep each other, keep our community members safe. Because, like it was said previously, a beautiful thing about Humboldt is that we live in a bubble, but we can no longer pretend that this is not going to come here. And we need to be prepared. Because I think a lot of people in our community are afraid that this will escalate. And I think just what's really important to us as a community is communication between us and law enforcement so that we're all on the same page and we know what to expect of each other.
After the public comment period, board member Lawrence Givener read a statement, quote, expressing my concern regarding the events unfolding in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and other places, and he backed up the public comment about egregious federal enforcement.
Authorized only with finding and detaining undocumented immigrants, they act with impunity, violently profiling, targeting, and assaulting men, women, and children without reasonable suspicion, probable cause, or judicial warrant, sometimes citing a vague federal statute ostensibly prohibiting impeding a federal official. People have been injured and killed. Shielded by the current federal administration, they claim absolute immunity from oversight or accountability.
Givener said city police should report egregious federal actions as critical incidents to the board and county and state law enforcement agencies. Board member Raul Torres agreed that the community should be informed on how police would respond to federal operations. City manager Miles Slattery said there are discussions about putting out some information and, quote, there will be more information coming up. Slattery noted the oversight board's limited scope, but Torres vouched for a future agenda item on the interface between federal and local policing. In an informal thumbs-up vote, other board members supported agendizing the discussion for a near-future meeting. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Activists have called for a national shutdown tomorrow, Friday, January 31st, in solidarity with Minneapolis after two citizens were killed by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, in the city earlier this month. This strike follows a previous general strike that took place on January 23rd, where thousands of Minnesotans took to the streets in solidarity. Humboldt County joins other communities across the country in planning protests and demonstrations for tomorrow. Local peaceful protests have been planned for tomorrow outside of the Eureka Courthouse from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m., as well as on Saturday from noon to 2 p.m. The protests are planned by the Humboldt Regional 5051 and are endorsed by Food Not Bombs, Humboldt Young Democratic Socialists of America, Cal Poly Humboldt Students for a Democratic Society, and the Humboldt Anti-War Committee. KMA News spoke with Regional Coordinator for 5051 for Humboldt County, AJ, for more information on the event. Due to safety concerns, AJ did not give their last name for the interview.
Tomorrow has been called a national strike. It was called by National Strike US, which I believe is a group that comes out of Minnesota or is in solidarity with what's going on in Minnesota. It is an ICE out national strike. So our demand is ICE out of our cities, ICE out of our states, abolish ICE. And we are asking people to not go to work, not go to school, and not do any shopping. And we understand that that is really hard, especially in this economy. It's hard not to go to work. And for those who cannot miss work, who cannot miss school, and especially who cannot avoid making purchases, we encourage them to shop locally, shop small, specifically shop at businesses to help support businesses affected by the Arcata fire and make donations to the Arcata Relief Fund. We have a protest from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Eureka Courthouse later in the afternoon, so those who did not participate in the strike can also attend.
Aside from the killings of Renee Good and Alex Preddy in Minneapolis this month, at least six immigrants have died in ICE custody this year alone, according to the Department of Homeland Security. 32 people died in ICE custody last year. The goal of the general strike is to take aim at the economy as a means of mobilizing those in power to do something about what has been happening not only in Minneapolis, but across the country with ICE.
Well, just like other general strikes, the goal is to hurt big businesses, lobbyists, and the government where it hurts. And that is in their pockets, in the market, in the stock numbers. And the goal is to show them that we are not okay with ICE. We are not okay with what ICE is doing.
5051 started out as a grassroots organization with the goal of, according to their website, quote, to uphold the Constitution and end executive overreach, end quote. This year already has been busy for them, already having organized almost 10 protests this month alone. AJ elaborates more on what 5051 does and how the organizing process has been.
So 5051 is a grassroots, well, not so grassroots anymore, national organization that was initially founded with the goal of having 50 protests in all 50 states in one day. We have since absolutely blown past that goal. And we are now a national network of local chapters that help endorse our local groups' protests and also planning our own protests in accordance with the national network to create large national, international protests. 2026 so far, we've had 7. This weekend we'll make 8 and 9 in the month of January. I took over this position on January 8th. I've done 5 protests since then, so it has been one after another. But protests, they are hard to create the network, but once you get the steps down, once you get down everything that you need to do, and once you have a really good network and a good community like we do out here, you can get it done pretty fast. I think our biggest hurdle has just been a race against the clock, getting things out, getting flyers out, getting notifications out, getting press releases out. But luckily, recently, I got an assistant co-coordinator at 5051. Her name's Josie, and she's been helping a lot, and that's made things go a lot quicker, a lot smoother.
The day that the general strike is planned for is also significant, as a government shutdown currently looms. Currently, the Senate has been considering the appropriations package passed by the House back on the 22nd. It includes a bipartisan health package, but also contains bills for funding for different areas of government, including the Department of Homeland Defense. Democratic and independent senators from New England have already stated that they will not vote for legislation that includes funding for DHS, as well as many other Democratic senators. There have also been calls for Senate Majority Leader John Thune to exclude the bill from the $6 billion funding package. If they do not reach an agreement at the end of tomorrow, a government shutdown will occur. The protest on Friday is for the general strike, and the protest on Saturday is planned to be specifically focusing on ICE out.
This Friday, I do not anticipate as big of an actual protest. What I anticipate, hopefully, what I would like to see, is the community coming out in solidarity for each other in all different kinds of ways, because we all have different things that we can contribute. I really just want to reaffirm that community that we build having these protests, having people come out time and time again, and put that to good use.
Once again, the protests are planned for tomorrow from 4 to 6 outside of the Eureka Courthouse, as well as Saturday from noon to 2 p.m. in the same location. For more information, the email is 5051humboldt@gmail.com. KMA News will be there covering these protests, so stay tuned for continued protest coverage. In state news, Alameda County approves ICE-free zones, but actual impact may be minor, KPFA's Lauren Schmidt reports.
Immigrant rights advocates are celebrating the passage of Alameda County's ICE-free zones. But county leadership cautioned that despite the name, the policies do not actually prevent federal agents from entering county property or making arrests. County officials say local law enforcement will not intervene in ICE actions unless California state law is violated. Supervisor Nikki Fortunato Bass, who sponsored the proposals, outlined the responsibilities of local law enforcement in upholding the ICE-free zones.
They cannot intervene in other law enforcement actions, but they are able to communicate in terms of what is happening to facilitate support to those that might be engaged, as well as to ask what their business is and to verify that it is, in fact, law enforcement.
Addressing what enforcement will and will not look like on county property, Alameda County Sheriff Yesenia Sanchez said her office would not interfere with ICE operations.
If it's a publicly accessible area, they can effect an arrest in that area. If it's somewhere where the public doesn't have privy to or access to, we can definitely restrict that. With parking lots and open spaces, I just don't understand how that could be prevented, because the sheriff's office doesn't provide, security, like any kind of method to vet people in or out of those spaces. And we have a contract with courts somewhere, down here, where we have a vetting process, a choke point, if you will, where we can identify people before they come in. And we do. If you're coming in and you're advising us that you're a law enforcement officer, then we're going to ask for that proof to identify yourself with your ID. So, the open spaces is problematic. I just want to make sure that, I support our communities. I just want to make sure that our community knows the expectations of what an ICE-free zone is, I guess by definition. But I don't want them to think that you step into this area and here's a line and ICE can't cross it.
County Council pointed to Minneapolis, where a similar ICE-free zone ordinance had been disregarded and violated by ICE agents. By their assessment, ICE-free zones have limited ability to physically prevent federal agents from using county property, but go a step beyond symbolism. Officials say having the policy in place lays the groundwork for additional action, starting with cease and desist notifications. Supervisor Fortunato Bass said the county needed to make a clear statement with this vote.
So one of the things that we're trying to do here to protect our communities is recognize that there is strength in numbers, that we need to act together as a region, as a Bay Area county, whether it was Coast Guard Island or the Super Bowl in a couple weeks or some future potential threat. Part of this is really aligning around planning together, as well as taking a stand and saying the feds cannot commandeer our county controlled and owned property for these mass actions.
What could carry more weight against immigration agents is if they violate state law, like disregarding warrants or violating California's new mask law, which could prompt a response from the sheriff's office.
And I know that there's been questions about will you arrest ICE and all this other stuff, you know, valid concerns from our community. And I think that just overall, any individual who violates state law is going to be held accountable. So it doesn't matter who you are. And that is true for anybody that commits a crime. There should be no difference. So I'm committed to that.
Supervisor Nate Miley cautioned that he does not support measures that could put county law enforcement in a violent conflict with ICE. But he, along with the five other supervisors, ultimately voted in favor. For KPFA News, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
In national news, Maryland state lawmakers considering congressional redistricting map ahead of midterm elections, KPFA's Cade Young reports.
Maryland Governor Moore and Delegate Wilson provided testimony during Tuesday's hearing defending their redistricting bill. Moore presented his vision for why this bill, at this time, is so important.
It is imperative that Maryland do its part to ensure that Congress is able to function as a meaningful check on executive overreach. And now is the time for the General Assembly to do what Marylanders expect, debate the map, improve it if necessary, and then take the vote. Because make no mistake, what the President of the United States is doing right now is political redlining.
Maryland Republican delegates voiced their opposition to the bill, among them Delegate Jason Buckle.
These maps are clearly driven for a purely partisan purpose. No one talked about uniting communities of interest. No one talked about fairness. I think the word was used. Everyone talked about Donald Trump. Everyone talked about the House of Representatives.
The political intentions of the bill were not the only concern for the Republican caucus, as Delegate Jefferson Grist also worries that the new map improperly connects communities with disparate needs. He addressed this concern in a back and forth with Delegate Wilson.
I'm talking about the biggest change to this map. I'm talking about how we're moving folks in District 1 off the Eastern Shore, and we're moving it over to Columbia, Howard County.
And you're saying that you don't believe that they have anything in common?
They have absolutely nothing in common. And I can't imagine that the public input gave you that information to be able to make that change.
Wilson refuted both concerns over political motivations and irrational district lines.
This is not guaranteeing that you're going to get 8 progressives or 7 Democrats or 8 Democrats. What it's guaranteeing is, and for some of these areas that have been now spread out, that whoever wins that is now answerable to a larger populace, a more broader thinking populace.
The battle over the Maryland congressional map will continue to play out as the bill undergoes further debate before being voted on. For KPFA, I'm Cade Young.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. There was a hung jury in Rapid City, South Dakota, Wednesday in a case against founder and CEO of the Native-led organization Indian Collective, Nick Tilson. After 3 days of hearings, a mistrial was declared. Tilson's accused of assaulting a police officer in 2022. He's facing charges for aggravated and simple assault on a law enforcement officer and obstruction of a law enforcement officer, facing 26 years in prison. In a statement, Tilson said he's grateful for everyone who stood with him, adding, "The fight's not over." The state has 45 days to notify the judge of intentions to retry the case. The rate of Alaskans dying from drug overdoses declined by 5% in 2024 compared to the year before, including a decline for Indigenous Alaskans, according to a recent state report. That's a welcome reduction after the state saw its highest number of overdose deaths on record in 2023. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra reports.
The United States has seen significant declines in overdose death rates over the past 2 years. And now Alaska could be seeing the start of a similar reduction, according to experts. Teresa Walton is a manager for Alaska's Office of Substance Misuse and Addiction Prevention. She says the decline is good news for the state, even though the state's reduction is much smaller than the national one.
I think we're on the right track.
And she says the decline is likely partly due to state efforts. The report notes the state distributed 45,000 naloxone kits in 2024 with fentanyl test strips. The state has mobile crisis teams in Anchorage, Matsu, Fairbanks, Ketchikan, and Juneau. and Alaska has expanded access to medication-assisted treatment, recovery housing, and therapeutic courts. But Welton says there's more work to do, and it will require a collaborative effort among the state, tribal organizations, and local communities.
Even with nationally, everybody is trying to look for that magic fix to start decreasing these deaths. And I think it's just a combination of supporting communities to address these issues at a community level and emphasizing prevention.
She says it's expensive to build treatment facilities, so increasing access to buprenorphine and other medications for substance use disorders could help prevent overdose deaths. She says Alaska struggles with having enough resources to provide treatment for substance use disorders, partly because rural residents must travel for treatment. According to the report, fentanyl is Alaska's deadliest drug. It contributed to more than 70% of overdose deaths in 2024. But Welton says it's crucial to note that many of the overdoses with fentanyl also included one or more other substances. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
This week, the U.S. Mint released this year's Native American $1 coin featuring Polly Cooper. The Oneida Indian Nation says she's recognized for bringing food and supplies to her homelands in upstate New York to Army troops at Valley Forge during the winter of 1777-78. The tribe says recognizing Cooper and the tribe as allies is timely as the U.S. prepares to observe the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. The coin depicts Polly Cooper with General George Washington as she holds a basket of corn. Cooper stayed at the camp through the winter and taught soldiers how to prepare corn and cook for them in harsh conditions to help ensure their survival. Oneida Indian Nation Representative Ray Halbritter says the Oneida people became America's first allies on some of the bloodiest battlefields of the Revolutionary War. According to the tribe, nation members continue the legacy of military service, serving in every major American conflict since then. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Dennis Marr, and thanks to our reporters, Gabriel Zucker, Daniel Mintz, Lauren Schmidt, Kate Young, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMA News is online, and you can find us on KMA.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Matt Cardos.